And we're going to step out of order a little bit and work and do the House Bill 2747 as a work session on it. And so I'll open a work session on 2747, and Janet, get us up to speed on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2747 was the bill heard March 14th that disconnects Oregon income tax and corporate excise taxes from federal law that permits accelerated depreciation for certain motor vehicles. This was the bill about the high heavy SUVs and heavy pickups that get a tax exemption and an accelerated depreciation. You have at your places this morning a dash one amendment. This was worked out between the sponsors of the bill and the Farm Bureau. The dash one amendments would limit the effect of the disconnect to vehicles between 6,000 and 14,000 pounds designated to seat nine or fewer passengers and not equipped with open cargo areas or covered cargo boxes separate from the passenger compartment. So it would still let you get the depreciation in on your Oregon taxes for those cargo type vehicles, but not for the what we're calling SUVs. It specifies that the disconnect does not apply to farmers also who file a Schedule F for federal tax purposes for the tax year in question. Mr. Chair, that's what the amendments do. Reminder that this bill has a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee. And the bill has a minimal fiscal impact.
Thank you, Janet. Senator Starr, did you want to make some?
Ringo.
He and Charlie are very much
this
alike.
This is not a very good start. I apologize. thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't make any return jokes because I want my bill passed. So, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This just to refresh your recollection, this bill is intended to offset the loophole where self-employed professionals, lawyers, doctors, dentists are getting accelerated depreciation off $50,000 SUVs. It was really meant this tax code section was really meant to allow farmers to get accelerated depreciation on their schedule. And we've worked with the Farm Bureau. Don Schellenberg is here. He says he is fine with the amendments that we've drafted. I think we may need to have some further tweaking of this when it gets to revenue, because Janet Adkins informs me that there still is a loophole that perhaps a dentist, if they're filing a Schedule F return for, they're not even a farmer, but they just file a Schedule F for some minor purpose, they'll still get some accelerated depreciation. So we need to tweak that, but I think it's best if we can keep the bill moving, and we'll do it before it gets to revenue. But I really appreciate your courtesies in moving this bill.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Dingfelder, do you have
any? No, I think Senator Ringo did an excellent job explaining our work with the committee staff and also revenue staff and legislative counsel. And I just wanted to thank all of them for helping us work through this. And as Senator Ringo said, we still have a little bit of tweaking to do, but we're confident we can work that out in the Revenue Committee.
Thank you. Any questions on the
Mr. Chair, so it takes effect January 2004? Yes?
Mm-hmm.
I still have time to run out and buy my Hummer? And
that you do, Representative Zahner.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator.
You're welcome.
We need some motions.
Are we in work session?
Mm-hmm. We are in work session.
Can I move dash one amendments to 2747 on behalf of my own senator.
Okay. Representative Greenleck moves the adoption of the dash one amendments to 2747. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, they are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2747 with the dash one amendments to the Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dingfelder moves House Bill 2747 as amended to the Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, Ryan, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Hingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Dillman.
Aye.
Representative Greenland.
Aye.
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. And motion carries. Okay, now we're down to...
Take care, Charlie.
Well, let's see, 2666. Mm-hmm. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2666, and Janet, please once again get us up to speed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2666 is a bill that would provide that a person who applies for either issuance or renewal of a driver's license or permit or an identification card is deemed to be giving consent to being registered with the United States Selective Service System if the person is required, is at the age that they're required to by law register. It prohibits the Department of Transportation from issuing the license, permit, or card to a person under the age of 26 unless the person does sign this consent on the application form. You have at your place the Dash 1 amendments. We just received this morning, and I'm not sure that my summary explains them very well, but it does provide that the director of the Department of Transportation will seek reimbursement for the amount that they do need to spend to implement this change from the Selective Service System, and that there is an appropriation clause in Section 4 and an emergency clause. And if you look at the original bill, the amendments delete lines 10 through 16 and insert the language on lines 4 through 6 of the amendment that the department shall place a notice on the application that submission of the application constitutes consent to being registered with the Selective Service System. Mr. Chair, there's background on the staff measure summary, and there's representatives from the Selective Service System to explain the measure. This bill does not have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, but you may want to consider adding one with the amendments that are under consideration. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Good morning, folks.
Morning.
Good morning.
If you would like to go ahead and give your testimony and identify yourself for the record, then, please.
Chairman Brown, my name is Gary Lockwood. I'm the Oregon State Director of Selective Service, which is a part-time job only, and hopefully will remain a part-time job. We have with us today a representative of the Selective Service full-time staff, and that is Diana Clevin, is the region director from Region 1. Even though we're in Region 3, Diana is a resident of Oregon, spent a number of years in the Eugene area, and was on the staff of the Selective Service unit here in Oregon. And she is our expert on this legislation, which has been enacted at this time in 28 states. Similar legislation, not exactly the same, but similar. And I'm going to ask her to give you the basic information on it, and then at the conclusion we'll be open to questions and have several other people that will be testifying on this. Diana, would you proceed?
Thank you.
Sure. As Mr. Lockwood pointed out, I'm a Eugene resident. I'm presently stationed at Great Lakes Naval Station, which is just north of Chicago. There are three region headquarters in the country. One is in Denver, one is in the Chicago area, and one is in Atlanta. I am presently, as he said, serving as a Region 1 director and the first female to have been selected to serve as a region director. I have a master's degree from the University of Oregon in public affairs. And because of being a region director, I'm presently registered as an independent and vote in virtually all of the Oregon elections. And all of mine end up being vote by mail. So I'm here to testify in support of the bill. There are two key reasons that I'm supporting this bill. One is that I'm committed to equity in any future draft.
and the other is out of concern for the young men who presently turn 26 in the state of Oregon who fail to register, and because of failing to register, permanently lose some key benefits. Among those are federal employment, federal grants and loans, access to federally funded job training programs, and citizenship for those who are not citizens. The Selective Service System and the research that it has done in the past has determined that most of the young men who don't register do not do that because of trying to make some sort of political statement or out of some sort of moral beliefs. But basically what we found is that most of them who don't register do so because they don't realize that there's an obligation to register. There's no draft, therefore they don't understand that there's a requirement. Typically, those individuals tend to be from lower income areas, and they tend to live in urban areas. And in concert with that, then they are also those who can least afford to lose those benefits that I mentioned before. In Oregon last year, of the young men turning 18, about one quarter of them did not register on time. That was down 4% from the year before. Typically, though, as far as overall compliance rate for young men in Oregon, it usually ranges from, or is usually about 10 or 15% of them who do not end up registering. The other reason I'm here is out of concern for those who have registered. Two of the reasons that working for Selective Service is important to me is being able to work within a system to try and ensure equity within the draft, if there were a draft. And the other thing is that for those who should be exempted, it's important to be there to make sure that those who are authorized, those exemptions, deferments, or reclassifications are granted them. A lot of young men, when they get the notice from Selective Service it's time to register, are anxious about it. It's a difficult thing to sign your name on a line knowing that if there were a draft, you could be called up. So necessarily, they are somewhat fearful in doing that. But part of the problem when you have a lower compliance rate is that the pool from which potential draftees can come is smaller, and that places then those young men who have registered at greater jeopardy of being called. This came home to me more this past year than it has in the past, in that my son turned 18 and wrestled with the morality of whether or not registering was the thing to do. Ultimately, the decision he reached was that he would comply with the law, and did so. And I have concern for him and other young men like him who go through that moral struggle, then agree to comply with the law, and then are placed in greater jeopardy. So that's another reason that I'm here. I believe that the liability should be equal. In the states where this legislation has passed, we have virtually 100% compliance. In most cases, they've been able to implement it at no cost or virtually no cost, because it basically is an electronic file transfer process, and they are not collecting data that they weren't already collecting anyway. So I would urge you to pass the bill. I would ask you to help protect those thousands of young men who do not register from losing those benefits when they turn 26, and I would ask that you ensure greater equity for the young men who do comply with the law and are registered. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any of your questions.
Thank you. Any questions, committee? Representative Greenland.
Hi.
Oh,
thank you for coming. I didn't miss something. We haven't passed the draft, have we?
We have not passed the draft.
And is there a movement? Is there a bill in
there's no indication
moving forward?
There's been no indication of a return to a draft. But what Selective Service has done since back during the Carter administration, when Afghanistan was invaded by the Soviet Union, there has been a registration in existence. So we're basically an insurance policy such that if there should be a need to return to a draft, that the mechanism is there.
May I follow, sir?
Follow.
You say there are two issues that sometimes people morally decide, as your son may have decided. He didn't, but he might have decided for moral or religious or ideological reasons not to, and then some people don't know. Wouldn't it serve just as well to have a form that said, here's the law, if you haven't registered, if you'd like to, check this box and sign it, and we'll forward your information? And wouldn't that serve just as well for the, if you're really only worried about making sure?
Well, that's the present, I mean, that's essentially the present situation as it exists. They are sent a form where they, whereby they can.
No, I mean with the driver's license.
Well, there are a couple of things that come to mind regarding that. One is that you now create additional work for the clerk at the DMV that doesn't exist by virtue of this bill. This bill says that by applying for a driver's license application, then you are consenting to register with Selective Service. And the other thing is that if you create a situation in which someone goes on record as opposing registration, then you place them in greater jeopardy of being convicted of the felony of not registering, whereas right now that's not the case. Or this bill would not cause that to happen either. And we have, if we also presently do not classify anyone in any manner other than not presently available for induction. So, so for example, in the case of a conscientious objector, if you have some formalized manner in which they would need to acknowledge presently that they should not be called or that they are a conscientious objector, what about the young man who, upon receipt of his induction, sits there and is contemplating whether or not he feels that there's some sort of moral dilemma with killing? I mean, he may not have ever signed something saying that he was a conscientious objector before that point. And then, when you have draft boards looking at that, and they may call into question the fact of whether or not you ever submitted such a statement in terms of whether or not your claim is legitimate. Does that answer your question?
Perhaps I could add something to this. In the system that was in existence prior to 1980, when our present law was passed, the classification took place up front. When you received, after receiving your notice or after registration, then there would be correspondence with the draft board, and there were full-time Selective Service people in each state, and there was some processing and some classification. You would be 1A through whatever might be with student deferments and all. The present rule is that every male who is residing within the United States between the ages of 18 and 25 are required to register. All citizens, wherever they may be, are required to register. There is no classification taking place until such time as there might be a call-up. And the reason is it would cost just literally millions of dollars to go through that classification, which might never come into being. And so that's the reason now it to have maximum registration. And the second part of this that we do is to have our board members in each county in the state of Oregon. We have 25 local boards that, if there were a call-up, these local boards then would be called into play to actually review issues of deferments and issues of the conscientious objectors. The framework is there to protect the people. The two areas that we can't play catch-up if there is a need for the draft, and at this time there is no indication that that is going to happen. But if it were to happen, the place we have to be ready is registration and trained board members. They can replace us in a in a heartbeat. We're not that important in the system, but to have trained board members, which are the really the integrity and the conscience of the system, they must be in place, and well, they are, and they're trained in the state of Oregon, each county having one or more, and the registration, which is the integrity of the pool. Those are the two things, and that's really the integrity of the pool and the protection of benefits is really the thrust of this bill.
Representative Krupp has joined us, and he's the sponsor of the bill, so I'd ask him to come up and join these folks up here and give his testimony, and then we'll go back to the question.
Also, in answer to what you were asking before, there's nothing that precludes a young man from right now writing a letter to the Data Management Center, and they receive letters regularly from young men who say, choose not to register. And there is nothing, other than the legal boundaries, if there were a draft. I mean, we had people who evaded the draft before. So, I mean, they still have those two options available to them. There are consequences to those choices. But I don't think that those differ any more from signing a statement saying, I do not choose to register, because that in itself is the same act of noncompliance with the Military Selective Service Act.
Clarify that.
Good morning, Representative.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp, House District 17. It's my pleasure to be before you this morning for two bills. This is the first, and wanted to really just share with you briefly why I produced this piece of legislation. Was really because I felt that this was a proper direction for us to go as a state in terms of seeking full compliance for everyone who is required to register for selective service. And that includes, of course, females. Females traditionally, while I have very strong feelings that I would rather not have females involved in combat, as we know today in Iraq, there are number of females flying combat aircraft, and it appears that in the new age of a progressive society that this is the direction they've chosen to go. And if we're going to comply fully, I think this is proper. I think it's the right thing to do. I never registered for the draft, because when I turned 18, there was a very short window of time where in the United States of America you were not required to do so. Otherwise, I would have been happy to have complied with it. My father was a conscientious objector in the mid-50s, shortly after the Korean War and before the Vietnam conflict. And he chose to serve out his 2 years. At that time, you could do what's called alternative service. And he chose to do that in Portland, driving a truck for Goodwill. And that's where my parents met and got married and lived, shall we say, very Spartanly for a long time. Served his public service in that manner. And I just, even though I don't have any history with the draft, my son has registered for the draft. He's 24 years old. Required to by law, complied, I make sure of that. And I think this is proper change. Again, we've had a changing society. I think this fully complies with the intent of the federal law, and I think we should move forward. So with that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Beyer, you had some questions.
Yes, thank you for all being here. My question, and it might really pertain more to DMV, is that we struggle constantly to make sure that our drivers on the road are licensed and are insured. And I'm kind of curious about the results of this in the other states. It seems to me like this might be something that would cause a person not to actually get a license. So they're out driving without it or without proof of insurance. And without making any moral judgments on drafts or anything else, that's a concern. So if you have any response to this, I'd appreciate hearing it.
Well, I don't think we've had any indication of a rampant problem in the other states where it's been implemented, but or any cases in which we anyone's identified that that's the reason that they weren't licensed. But I think you have to look at there's certain privileges that you have in society, but this is one of those instances in which a privilege is being associated with a responsibility, and it just seems appropriate to me.
I'd like to respond, Representative. I think that, and I don't know if DMV has the figures with them here, but I would say that of the folks that I know of that do not have insurance and drive illegally, either without driver's licenses or with the proper insurance coverage under Oregon law, usually those are either economic reasons or there's some other reason in terms of legal status in this country that tend to drive those issues. And I'm not sure if the registering for the draft is enough of a component to make a person decide to not do it. In many cases, you just can't afford it because you perhaps have, in your youthful exuberance, have had a number of traffic violations, and the cost of insurance for you is beyond what you can pay because of choices you've made, and you choose to not drive, or you choose to drive illegally. I'm not sure that this particular issue would really impact that. I'm not sure it would really change the numbers of folks, perhaps. I think they're driving illegally for other reasons.
Representative Mabry.
I guess I share the feeling of patriotism and the responsibility of people to support their government in times of need, and certainly the draft would be a time of need if it were instituted, and a concern for young people that may unintentionally lose their privilege for government employment or those kinds of things. But we have lots of responsibilities that are requirements that we're required to do. One of them is to drive responsibly and obey the laws and those kinds of things. And if we don't do that, we lose our driving privilege. But the other privileges are the other responsibilities, like filing income tax if you're required to. And they don't come immediately to mind, but there's a lot of things we're required to do that have nothing to do with driving. And to tie a driver's license to those responsibilities, I'm not sure makes sense to me. And secondly, and you may have, Representative Krupp, already addressed this because I didn't catch that, but, you know, this talks about young men mm-hmm. required to register. In this day and age of equal rights and equal responsibilities and equal pay and equal everything, it would seem not right for a young man to be deprived of the privilege of driving because he didn't register, when a young woman, having done the same thing, is not denied that. Could you address those concerns in some way?
Well, I'd be happy to share my thoughts and encourage the folks up here also to share their thoughts. But it's my understanding that looking at the language of the bill, unless there's been an amendment that I have not seen, that this applies to person in the rather objectives.
And the bill says if the person is required by federal law to register. Mm-hmm. Are females required to register now by federal law?
Not at this time.
And so I would read that they're probably excluded from this.
Okay. Well, thank you for clarifying that for me.
Yeah.
I have about 60 bills in the works, so it's hard for me to keep all of them straight. Go ahead, Colonel.
If I could address the equity issue, I spend a lot of time attempting to reach what is historically the 10% that we consider that kind of falls through the cracks. The people who are not, who are high school dropouts, the people who are the undocumented farm workers, and that's a large portion of that 10% that we are just unable to reach. the equity from my standpoint is that these are people who lose these employment benefits, including education assistance, retraining, working for the government, the post office, and probably the biggest is the issue of citizenship. That if someone who is not a citizen wants to become a citizen, if they unfortunately again it is gender directed, but a male who fails to register by age 26 cannot. There is no makeup for that. They have to then face the immigration processes, and the burden is on that individual to prove that they did not reasonably know that there was a registration requirement. If they cannot prove that, it is a lifetime debarment for citizenship. That's the place where that I have really the most concern. I get calls regularly from immigration attorneys who are fighting this problem for their clients, and this goes a long ways to correcting that. We have, I think, a speaker today who would also address that from her standpoint in working with the same group of residents of our state.
And Mr. Chair, I'd like to add that in regards to Representative Mabry's comments, it's appropriate to hold people accountable in life. Nothing is more important, I think, than our nation's security right now. I think the events of September 11th and actually preceding events have presented that very starkly to our mindset. And having a pool of people that you can draw upon if you need them, I think is important to our country's security. It certainly has been in the past. I think we're moving into a new age of warfare where we will rely on greater advances in technology and probably will mean less individuals. I think our volunteer army has done remarkably well. If you compare this country's history in World War I, World War II with drafts, all the way up through Korea and Vietnam, we're doing so much more with less personnel today. And I think that the new age battlefield will not be large Kursk-type tank battles that happened during World War II. I think you will see in the age of terror smaller paramilitary forces that rely on a great deal of technology. And I firmly believe that will not require us to ever have to go to a draft again. But were something to happen that we would, and I think it's very appropriate that we hold individuals accountable in this manner to comply with the law, because the nation's security is first and foremost in my mind.
Representative Greenlake, you had some more questions? I've got them answered now. Okay. Is there any other questions?
I guess I have one more.
Representative Mabry.
We have done, I think, fairly good job of getting people to register to vote. You can't go into a post office and change your address without being given the opportunity. You can't go to a DMV office without an opportunity to register to vote. You can't go to a courthouse and get a marriage license or anything without the opportunity to register to vote. Would it not be just as effective without eliminating that ability to drive to treat this issue in a similar way to make sure that there's every opportunity in every location to inform young people, young men, of their requirement to register without making it a requirement of your driving privilege is what I'm trying to say.
Well, Representative, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mabry, I sense you're struggling with reaching some sense of comfort with the direction we're headed here. And I would say that, again, this law applies until the age of 26. I think back to the days when I was, I grew up on a farm, so I could drive at a pretty young age. I couldn't wait to get my license.
I could
drive around the fields. And I couldn't wait to get my license because in America, and American young men typically, in our society, and we're very unique throughout the world, we want to drive, especially in the West, where we have vast differences. I live 30 miles from the closest town I could go drag the gut on Saturday night. And so I think this is a great motivator. If you realize as a young man that you have to comply with the law and that you may lose your driving privileges as a result of that, then driving's pretty important to you. And I think it's a good motivator, and it'll basically say to a young man, because I'm just kind of thinking back to my youth and what I would have thought at the time, and I think I would have thought, you know, this is not a big deal. I'll just go do this. And, you know, the appropriate protections are there for other folks who have, you know, great religious issues with that. And I grew up in a Mennonite community where a lot of my Mennonite neighbors are very conservative. They don't have radios. They don't have televisions. They don't vote. And they don't participate in this manner. They have always had alternative service available, as my father did, because of religious grounds. So I think it is an appropriate way of holding young men accountable, because out here we hold driving privileges as a, especially in the rural communities, as a great privilege. And if you really want them to comply, then I think this is a great way to do it.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. Thank you, folks. Did you have something?
I was just going to add that we have historically had cards, registration cards in every post office with the sign, and we still have the same, maintain the same, about 10% ultimately by age 26 that are not registered. And it's the young people who go to college, when they apply for financial aid, as most do these days, they check the block, they're registered as a result of that, because that's one of the requirements for financial aid. But that those 10% that I refer to as dropping through the cracks don't have that opportunity. This is that opportunity for them to have the equality of the law, in my estimation. Thank you.
One more question. Representative Barr.
I'm sorry. When you mentioned that 10% that never really changes, what about the states that have enacted this? What is the percentage there?
Most of them are right at, in the high 90s to 100% of the potential registrants.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you again, folks.
Thank you. I think we have one more person that has signed up.
Could I have Mary Lou Corns and Kelly Taylor both come up, please? Good morning, Mary Lou.
Good morning, sir. How are you this morning?
Real good.
Good.
Whenever you're ready to start.
Okay, well, I was sitting back there listening to the pros and cons and weighing in as a woman, as a veteran, and also as the lower 10% that would be a minority piece probably in the equation. But one of the things that struck me is...
I'm going to get you to identify yourself
yes,
for the record, please.
Mary Lou Cornejo, and I work with Oregon State University, and I'm on comp time right now to took time out of the day because this is very, very important to me.
Thank you.
Anything else I need
to
be
No, you've got to say it. No, you can go ahead.
Sorry.
Thank you again.
But as I was sitting back there and listening to the pros and cons and remembering also some of the issues that people might have with this, I remember going through the checklist for myself and this underserved audience and part of the minority piece that I represent also, and thought, you know, as an American born and raised in the United States, second generation, and looking at how when we grew up, driving was a, I think I'm with the person that said, or the representative that said, those rural communities, that there's not a whole lot to do. You depended on that car to get you to connected to the bigger piece. And so in looking at all these things that went through my mind, and I'm sorry I'm feeling a little disconnected, but I certainly support this bill, and I will let you know that I'm a firm believer that Oregon is a great state, number one, and that as a citizen, we all have a duty to comply with the laws, not just of Oregon, but of the United States. When we look at my service in the Guard, I was in the Oregon Army National Guard for 24 years. 20 of them were active duty years. And thought of the woman piece, and someone raised the question, well, you know, is it a piece that's leaving out women? Well, we've been left out because of the combat probability code, which states that no woman will be in a direct combat. But the representative said something that was really, really true, in the fact that nowadays wars are being fought different, high tech. Before you could count on a rare echelon, now it's swirling masses of fire, and we could attest to that where that young woman was captured. But to go back to this bill, and I kind of wanted to clarify that for some that didn't understand that piece as a veteran and having served, is the fact that, back to the driver's license, you know, everyone has to drive. People do it whether they have insurance or don't have insurance. Why? Because the necessity is born out of necessity for that lower 10%. And I really thought about this bill. I truly support it because, again, we go back to the fact that we all live here in Oregon. Everyone. I don't care if you're documented or undocumented or whatever. You're still a citizen of Oregon for the time that you're here. And that means that everyone should be able to register. If the law says you need to register, that's the way you got to go. And tying it to DMV, I think that's a perfect place to tie it in. Why? Because if you tied it into taxes, how many people are dropped through the loop because they don't understand the system? They don't understand the structure? But they do understand that you need to go get a driver's license or an ID card. So that piece becomes very, very clear in my mind. And as I sit before you today, I would certainly hope that you dig in, because for me it is an equity issue. We all live here in Oregon. I'll go back to that piece. And we should all be held accountable, every single one of us. So if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Thank you, ma'am. Any questions? Don't look like it. Kelly, will you go ahead and give your testimony then, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kelly Tater, Department of Transportation. I just wanted to speak to the bill, the amendments, and the fiscal impact. This is one of those items where we cannot use highway funds because it's only certain people that it affects, et cetera, and all of that. So that's why in the Dash 1 amendments it's mentioning appropriations from the general fund, et cetera. The workload associated with the bill, driver license and ID cards, originals and renewals in a biennium together are about a quarter of a million transactions. So even with the number of folks that haven't registered, because according to our records we've been able to find, what we've been able to check, excuse me, our research, about 92% probably have already registered, but you're still dealing with about 8% that may not, so you've got to go through that. It equals about one position worth of effort out in the field offices. There is some general fund impact, some position impact that we cannot use highway fund on. It equals about $76,000 in the biennium between some programming and the forums, et cetera, and the personnel. The one thing I will say on the Dash 1s, because I did work with Mr. Lockwood on the amendments, but the Section 5, the lines 16 through 18, the emergency clause catches me by surprise. I was not aware that an emergency clause was going to be added. And frankly, I would want to have that deleted in because that is a lot of forms to revise. There are some other bills going through that will affect forms, statements on forms, signatures on forms, and I wouldn't want to have to revise it. Try to revise it by July 1. I'm not even sure we could get the bid out and get it revised by July 1, and then have other bills go through that have a later date. We thought we were still on the assumption that this was a January 1, 2004 bill, and that's the way we put our fiscal together. So, anyway, that would be my comments. To us, it does need to go to Ways and Means to get the appropriations, et cetera.
Representative Breyer.
Thank you. And this might be to Mr. Lockwood, or is it? I'm not sure how
yes.
to address it.
Okay.
Just this past Friday, I delivered a letter to Peter DeFazio requesting that the federal government start reimbursing the state for expenses that they had promised. No Child Left Behind, special education funds, the security, Homeland Security piece. My concern is how reliable is this reimbursement piece in this bill for the state?
At the present time, all of the states receive electronic tapes from motor vehicle departments. The thing that is different about this bill, it takes it a step further and makes the implied consent. The position of Selective Service is that they will work with the motor vehicle department for reimbursement. And what I see is that the state is in the control position. If the agency doesn't pay what it agrees to pay, motor vehicle department doesn't send the tapes forward. So I think the control issue is here for that. And I don't see this in the same light as many of the other federal programs of do this and we'll pay you. It's pay or you don't get our tapes. I think that's the safeguard for the state of Oregon.
But are they still required to do the process to get the information onto the tapes? Whether or not they're going to turn them in or reimburse for them, they're still.
Well, I think if there wasn't payment, I would assume they would be a cease and desist of gathering the information. It has not been a problem in the states that have enacted this, to the best of my knowledge. Now, some of those decisions are above my pay grade. I don't have a budget to do this, but it's been in all of the states that have enacted the legislation, there's a negotiation with as to how the payment's made, and we have an annual federal budget opposed to the biennium budget in the state, and it varies with probably each state on how they do it. But I don't think the reimbursement for the cost of doing this service is a problem, because there is ultimately a cost savings to the agency. So it's a trade-off in that, and I can't agree to any that yes, there's a fund that I can say X number of dollars be paid, but we have somebody at the national level that takes care of that with the states, and I'm very comfortable that they will do what they say they're going to do. But if they don't, I think State of Oregon has the ability to say, sorry, you didn't pay, you don't get the information.
One quick follow-up.
Okay, follow-up.
And this is addressed to Kelly. Would this be your interpretation of how this is?
Mr. Chair and Representative Beyer, that's been one of the questions that I was sitting or thinking as you guys were talking. There's two pieces to this. There's the cost to revise the form and have discussions with some percent of the population. That's where the FTE, et cetera, comes in, and that would be need to be not only for startup costs but ongoing costs covered by general fund. And that is where in the dash one it says we then seek reimbursement. I don't know whether reimbursement will come when we just send a letter, but you don't know whether you'll get it back to pay back to general fund. The other piece, so that's one cost. The other cost is to produce records. Now, those have to be paid up front, and so if Selective Service were to say, hey, DMV, we'd like a file of everybody that's between the ages that has applied in these dates, that's between the ages, yada, yada, in the mail, that's about $700 a report, and we wouldn't produce it unless they paid us for it up front. But the setup cost and ongoing cost, that $75,000, $76,000 or so a biennium, that's where the state's out some general fund waiting for reimbursement. Now, when we did our research on this, I know that there must have been some other states that had the same questions, because we noticed in Tennessee's law that they said they would enact this when the funds arrived from the feds. So they put it on their books, but they put a caveat that they would implement it only when funds were received.
Thank you. Representative Greenland.
Well, let's say the federal government says, no, we're not going to pay you anything. And does that do away with this act that requires you to get consent for the registration and requires you not to issue a driver's license unless that consent is...
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlick, the law would be on the books. The funding would need to come from the general fund, and if we had general fund carried out, we would carry it out. If we did not have general fund to carry it out, we couldn't, because it would be unconstitutional for us to spend highway funds. So that would become a budget issue with the legislature to decide whether or not they wanted to fund that piece of the law or whatever.
So, may I follow? So you're suggesting you could issue a driver's license in violation of this law.
Ah, I see what you're saying. Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlink, I'm sorry, I misunderstood. The way the original bill is drafted, that would be tough. We would be in a hard spot, because it'd be saying don't issue a license if somebody refuses, but we really don't have the funds. If we didn't have general funds, we wouldn't have the funds to even get to that question. So I'm not sure what we would do. I would have to talk to our Attorney General about that. I see what you're saying. We would be between a rock and a hard place.
Any other questions? Thank you, folks.
Mm-hmm. For the record, I'd like to state that I was surprised at the emergency provision on this tube. That was not requested by our agency, so I would join Kelly in saying that that's not a necessary part of our request.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Laughlin.
Thank you very much, Chairman, committee members.
Ed Hughes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, sir.
I feel more comfortable with Colonel Lockwood here. He's one of the best lawyers in Oregon. my name is Ed Hughes, 16 years spokesman for Oregon's veterans. They've looked at this legislation. Colonel Lockwood has asked us to assist, and so is the sponsor. The veterans have an approach. It's a little bit different. I think what they're thinking at this point in time is that with the current situation, we probably need this. And secondly, they brought something up that was refreshing and unusual, as they usually do. They said that, you know, when a young person goes down to register, and even if they're asked to register at DMV, it does something for them that may help them. And that is, it makes them think that, you know, if I'm called up, where would I like to go? What would I like to do? What kind of a job would I like to have? And so the job issue came up, which I think is a good one. I think that it makes a young person think about military service and whether or not maybe they want to register for the draft, but maybe then they want to go join the Navy or the Marine Corps or whatever. I'm thinking that, yes, Oregon needs jobs. If this causes young people to think about possible military jobs, I think it's good. As you know, in the Portland area, we've had a terrible situation where the Portland School Board has literally thrown military recruiters out of the schools until recently, when the federal Supreme Court allowed them back in. But for 6 years, we lost a lot of good jobs for young people in the Portland area that wanted to pull themselves up by the bootstraps. I think that was a terrible thing. And maybe this will help offset some of that. I don't know, but I do think it does raise the issue in a young person's mind about military service and the veterans like that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you again for your testimony. Committee, I'm inclined to carry this bill over till Friday, and then we can clean up the emergency clause on that, and then send it on its way to Ways and Means for them to put the dollar figure in.
Mr. Chair, and maybe look. I mean, I'm fine with the bill. I think it's a good bill, but I do want the federal government to pay us for that one person. And so it'd be nice if we figure out a way to put that in the bill also.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Any other comment? We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2661, or 66. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2217. And Representative Krupp, again, please. Okay. All right. Should I have also Greg Del LaPonte and Curtis, Kirk Curtis, and who else is here? We'll go on to. There's some clackamas in there. Who's this up here?
Andy Eno.
Yeah. Andy Eno, please.
Chair.
Yeah, go ahead, Janet, and bring us up to speed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2217 would change Oregon statutes on truck safety to bring them into compliance with federal law. Probably the feature of the bill that most people are interested in and that would have the most effect are that provision that applies a farm vehicle exemption from commercial vehicle safety inspections only to vehicles in intrastate commerce. There are a couple of other provisions dealing with seat belts and hazardous materials, and the bill does declare an emergency. This bill has quite a bit of history. There was a task force last interim that Representative Krupp chaired, and so he has maintained continued interest in this bill. And the Department of Transportation has been under notification for several years that our exemption for farm vehicles from for interstate vehicles in interstate commerce is too broad, and this is the legislation that would take care of that and bring us back into compliance. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Jen. Representative Krupp, did you want to give testimony on this or just?
Yes, Mr. Chair, but after
they set the stage? Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Greg.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Greg Delpani. I'm the administrator for the Motor Carrier Division of the Department of Transportation here in Oregon. And I'm here this morning to talk to you about House Bill 2217. It is the case today that Oregon laws found in Chapter 825 of Oregon Revised Statutes, particularly 825.017 and 024, exempt most farm trucks and certain other trucks from safety regulations. And I think it's important to note that this has been the case for decades here in Oregon. And Janet Atkins is entirely correct. Of all the trucks that are involved in this matter, it is clearly the farm trucks and the farm situation that has generated most of the discussion regarding this bill. The state of Oregon receives a federal grant known as the Motor Carrier Safety Assistance Program, or MCSAP for short. And in an audit of that federal grant that occurred in the year 2000, federal auditors conducting the audit determined that the exemptions written in our statute were written too broadly. And by that they meant that it was well and good if the state chose to exempt categories of trucks from safety regulations when they were operating in intrastate commerce, but it was unsatisfactory when the state exempted these vehicles when they were operating in interstate commerce. Federal law requires that the trucks be subject to safety regulation whenever the vehicle is engaged in interstate commerce. I think it's also important to realize that farm trucks have always been subject to safety regulation when they're engaged in interstate commerce in Oregon. And there's a document published by the Oregon Department of Agriculture called the Oregon Farmer's Handbook. And this handbook clearly sets forth that farm trucks and farm operations are subject to safety regulation when they're engaged in interstate commerce. The difference is it's more or less the kind of uniform. Federal regulators have always had oversight over these vehicles when they're engaged in interstate commerce, but because of Oregon revised statutes, state regulators have not had that safety oversight. House Bill 2217 simply puts state regulators on equal footing with their federal counterparts. Now, as a result of the audit that occurred in the year 2000, the federal government has put Oregon on notice that we risk losing approximately $5 million per biennium in federal funds. And these federal funds are funds that are used exclusively for truck safety enforcement work. If we do not pass House Bill 2217 and take no action in this regard, on October 1 of this year, the state of Oregon will lose the federal grant amounting to $5 million approximately per biennium. And there's another threat here. In addition to applicability or eligibility for the federal grant, the state of Oregon also is at risk that the federal government may undertake a preemption proceeding and determine that the state may not enforce its state law that in essence conflicts with the federal law. The Secretary of the United States Department of Transportation can make that determination through a rulemaking. And I can tell you that, to my knowledge, that has occurred in at least one other jurisdiction, the state of Mississippi, for reasons almost identical to the situation we are looking at here this morning. Now, I can understand the concerns of the farm industry, which worries, in essence, that their critical harvest operations occurring in a very narrow time period under tight time constraints could be interfered with or interrupted by the work of safety inspectors in Oregon. That's a legitimate concern, and as business operators and farm owners, I'm sensitive to that concern. I understand the nature of their concern. However, I'd like to point out that if House Bill 2217 were to become law, the practical result in terms of on-the-road truck safety enforcement in Oregon would not change substantially, and there would be little or no observed impact to the farm operations. And the reason for that is that in the state of Oregon, we have a performance-based safety regulatory plan. And by that I mean we use safety data that we have available that tells us what kinds of trucks operating where under what circumstances tend to be represented in truck at fault accidents. And we consciously choose to invest our resources and focus our attentions on those trucks that are contributing to truck at fault accidents. And the fact of the matter is that our safety database tells us that farm trucks and farm operations are simply not a subject of major concern in that regard. Therefore, it would be inappropriate for us to devote our limited resources to intense scrutiny of farm trucks. We do have a lot to lose in this state by failing to act. And losing $5 million of federal safety enforcement funds would have a significant impact. These dollars are shared with law enforcement agencies all over the state. Approximately 57 partnering law enforcement agencies work with the Department of Transportation in our MixApp program. These law enforcement agencies are performing what we call level 2 or abbreviated truck inspections, performed in association with a probable cause stop. We know, for instance, that most truck accidents are not caused by mechanical deficiencies of trucks. They're caused by driver behaviors, following too closely, unsafe lane change, speeding, driving over allowable hours of service. We have purposely written our contracts with our MixApp partners to have them make probable cause stops when they observe these kinds of driver behaviors while they're outperforming their duties, patrolling the highways, and then conducting an abbreviated truck stop, including looking at the driver's hours of service records, the status of the commercial driver's license, etc., and then taking appropriate actions to take unsafe, unqualified drivers out from behind the wheel of those trucks. We have outcome-based performance measures which have been statistically verified using a regression analysis, which demonstrate beyond a shadow of a doubt that there is a valid correlation. And to the extent we are successful in removing these unqualified drivers through our MixUp program efforts, we have successfully reduced the truck at fault accident incidents in this state in each of the last 4 years. I can tell you unequivocally that based on our outcome-based performance measures and our statistical analysis, that a loss of this grant and a loss of that truck inspection activity will most definitely result across the state in an increase in truck at fault accidents and an increase in the attendant loss of life. Janet mentioned, and she is entirely correct, that the bill also includes some other conformity matters, more housekeeping than anything else, including an amendment to clarify that commercial motor vehicles drivers are not exempt when operating in interstate commerce from seatbelt requirements, and further federal regulations require that certain types of trucks stop at a railroad crossing whether or not there is a crossing device, and this bill also conforms Oregon law with federal requirements in that regard as well. That concludes my testimony, and I'm available to answer questions, but I would also like to draw to your attention that with me this morning to my left and to your right is Mr. Andrew Eno, who is the Division Administrator for the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration office here in Salem. And he is a representative of the federal government and can speak to their concerns.
Thank you. Andrew, you'd like to go ahead and give your testimony, please.
Good morning, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Andrew Eno. I am the Division Administrator for the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. Our agency is the modal agency of the U.S. Department of Transportation, and predominantly we concentrate on truck safety matters. With our agency partners with approximately 50 states, District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and the three territories, and to promote the adoption and uniform enforcement of safety rules, regulations, and standards compatible with the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration rules and the hazardous material regulations. And this is for both interstate and intrastate drivers. The primary arrangement we use to implement this is the, as Greg had mentioned, what's called the Motor Carrier Safety Assistance Program. The goal of that program is to reduce commercial motor vehicle involved accidents, fatalities, and injuries through consistent, uniform, and effective commercial motor vehicle safety programs. Oregon was one of the first states to implement this program in the mid-80s, and they participated for almost 20 years now, and they are definitely looked on as a model for other states. What is the impact of the MixUp program in Oregon? For the federal fiscal year 2003, Oregon received approximately $2.4 million in basic and incentive funds for their motor carrier program. As Greg mentioned, that comes out to almost $5 million over your biennium. Why has our agency asked the state of Oregon to modify their laws? Excuse me. As part of our authority, the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration has rules that cover farm operations and interstate commerce. Although this group enjoys many exemptions under our own rules, nevertheless, Congress has determined that some safety rules will still apply. ORS 825-24 exempts certain farm vehicles from Chapter 825, and for intrastate commerce, this is not an issue. However, the law is written so broadly that it exempts interstate farm vehicles from federal safety regulations also. This puts this section in conflict with federal regulations found in Title 49 of the Code of Federal Regulations, specifically 382, 383, 387, 391, 395, 396, which prescribe certain minimum requirements for interstate farm operations. One of the first requirements to receive MixUp funding is for the state to adopt commercial motor carrier and highway hazardous material safety rules and regulations that are compatible with the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations and the Hazardous Material Regulations. Compatibility means that state laws and regulations applicable to interstate commerce and to intrastate commerce of hazardous materials are identical to FMCSR and the HMR or have the same effect, which this law does not. State laws applicable to intrastate commerce are either identical to and have the same effect as our regulations or fall within certain established limited variances, and Oregon does take advantage of those. House Bill 2217 would allow Oregon to meet this standard. Is this strictly a grant issue? I know that's been a question. In other words, could the state of Oregon decide to keep the laws written and just decline to participate in MCSAP? And the answer is, even without the grant, the state would be subject to what's called the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution that rules that federal law is superior to state laws in cases of conflict, such as this. In addition to this clause, Title 49 of the U.S. Code, 31141, provides the U.S. Department of Transportation with the ability to preempt state law. Specifically, it states that if the Secretary, in parentheses of Transportation in this case, decides a state law or regulation is less stringent, which in this case it is, then a regulation prescribed by the Secretary, then a regulation prescribed by the Secretary, the state law or regulation may not be enforced. Although a waiver is included in the statute, I need to explain exactly what that means. The state of Oregon currently has a waiver application under discussion with our agency, and that waiver, if granted, would recognize the state has equivalent laws that have the same effect as the appropriate Federal Medicare Safety Regulations. I did check this morning, and as of this morning, the answer to the waiver has not been received. I will give you my personal opinion on it and say that I don't believe that it probably will be issued, but that's my personal opinion. This waiver, however, if it is approved, would allow the state to continue their enforcement of their version of the law, but does not relieve interstate operations of the duties and responsibilities under federal law and regulation. I need to emphasize that the interstate farm operations are still subject to the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations, and that our agency and any other state can and will enforce these rules. Further, neither House Bill 2217 nor the waiver, if approved by our agency, affects whether a carrier is considered to be as being in interstate or intrastate commerce. These rules are a separate issue, and with or without this bill, a grant program, or a commercial motor vehicle program in this state, a carrier that is in interstate commerce today will be in interstate commerce tomorrow if their operational characteristics stay the same. Another issue is, have any states lost grant money due to incompatible laws? And the answer is yes, but there's a two-part question. For intrastate commerce, there were three states that did. That's Florida, Maine, and South Dakota. They were allowed to enter the MCSAP program with laws that fell outside our tolerance guidelines, and these are strictly, we're talking about in this case, intrastate rules. The penalty they accepted was a 50% reduction in grant funds that continue to this day. That policy changed in the early 90s, and currently there is no 50% option. Either the state receives 100% money or nothing. For interstate commerce, there have never been tolerance guidelines like there is for intrastate commerce. And the reason we have tolerance guidelines is to go back to the purpose of what MCSAP is, and that's to have a group of laws that allow for uniform for carriers to be able to operate uniformly across state lines or within a state, and not have a hodgepodge of regulations that they have to deal with, which is actually the case before the rule went into effect. The MCSAP program came into effect. Once again, interstate commerce, there's never been tolerance guidelines. Either it is exact or it runs the risk of being preempted. Our standard process is to give the state 3 years to resolve the incompatibility through administrative or legislative means. This is actually the third year for this rule. If the state does not, and in the case of Oregon, that would occur September 30th, the rule will be preempted sometime after that, probably. As Greg mentioned, this occurred in 1995 when we preempted the Mississippi law that was very similar to what ORS 825.024 says. What does preemption mean? It just means that the state law may not be in effect and enforced with respect to commercial motor vehicles and interstate commerce. Just to tie up a couple loose ends here, just want to point out that the bill does not in any way change the definition of what inter or intrastate commerce is. Those definitions are based on longstanding laws and interpretation, predominantly those for surface transportation that were from the 1880s to the 1950s. Carriers operating in interstate commerce, including farm operations, must follow Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations, although, like I had mentioned earlier, there are many exemptions for them. The third item is the Constitution provides that when federal and state rules conflict, the federal rule of superior must be followed. Number four, currently, because of the way the wording is in the law, there's no distinction made between inter and intrastate commerce. Because of this conflict, the state of Oregon must remove this rule to be consistent with the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations. Failure to do so will result in loss of MCSAP funding as of October 1st. Additionally, the law is subject to preemption, regardless of whether the state of Oregon chooses to stay in the Motor Carrier Safety Assistance Program or not. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Zoller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are the federal laws or administrative rules?
I mean, they in statute?
Actually, this case it's both. We have law and regulation. And in the fact of preemption, the law actually states that our regulation, if a law or regulation of the state is different than our regulation, it's still preemptible.
Greg, for you, you know, you were out with our farmer friends last year out in St. Paul, and they're concerned with when they drive their trucks up to AgriPac and they're all lined up and you're weighing them all. Is this going to add further delay if you're going to start maybe to inspect all of those trucks at the same time? Can you reply to
Mr.
that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, I understand your question. As it is today, the farm trucks have always been and are still subject to size and weight enforcement. And on occasion, as they're moving their crop from field to AgriPac, as an example, there have been occasions where they've been stopped and they have been weighed. You're asking me, could they also be subject to a safety inspection at that time? And the answer is yes, they would be, and that's what this bill is all about. The federal government is requiring that our inspectors have the same authority to inspect as a federal counterpart, but they're not demanding that we do so, that we exercise that authority. And so I would fall back and I would answer this question by saying to you, the work that my staff perform in the field is directed by myself and through my safety program managers. And I would look at the safety database that we have, and I would make choices about what kinds of equipment to inspect based on the database that I have. The data that I have tells me that my efforts are not well invested in choosing to inspect farm trucks. So I suspect where the rubber meets the road in day-to-day operations that we would be choosing few farm trucks to inspect out of a stream of traffic. We make conscious decisions about what trucks to inspect and what trucks not to inspect.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Ray.
Representative Ringfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for either of you gentlemen regarding, maybe this is more appropriate at the federal level, but don't all states that receive these funds have to have the same inspection requirements? And maybe you can talk about what other states are doing, especially in the West.
No. Actually, every state, the guidelines for the MXAP program are the same no matter which state. So in other words, if this issue was to come up in Idaho or Nevada, they would have to follow the same process or risk losing the funds also. I mean, it comes back to the basis of the funding is to ensure that, you know, we have a uniform set of rules out there so that folks know what they can expect when they're out on the road operating. And that's what this is about. So if other states, I don't know of any other state that's at this point exactly right now. I don't. And I've contacted our headquarters this morning, and they didn't mention it, and we've been in contact lately, and I haven't heard of any. It's not that they couldn't. I mean, they could always change the law, which is a possibility in a state, and fall into this process also. But all states are expected to, as part of this, you know, follow, you know, basically respect that the federal government has jurisdiction over interstate commerce. We also respect that the state has jurisdiction over intrastate commerce. How can we make those two work together so that, you know, that the folks on the road know what to expect, the motor carriers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelder, just to add on to that response, I think if I heard you correctly, you were interested in if other states have similar exemptions for farm trucks. I asked the same question in the year 2000 when this audit was done. I was interested in whether or not Oregon was being treated differently. And the Salem Division Office of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration did a scan of the 11 western states for me and responded to my inquiry by telling me that no other state offered a similar exemption for farm vehicles operating in interstate commerce. They did offer the exemptions in intrastate, and that was acceptable within the federal regulations.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Greg, I understand that you are a much beloved and trusted deputy director, and the Farm Bureau does have a lot of faith in you. They're concerned beyond you and how things might work, and I can understand their frustration in that. So are you willing to do this death do us part type thing? Or
yeah, Meaning he can never leave his job.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beyer, I will commit for the record that I'll be exercising all due caution crossing streets, coming up and down the staircase. I appreciate the vote of confidence that's been expressed, but I would also tell you that what we do is not driven so much by Greg Delpani as it is by a very objective and methodical process which is embodied in our commercial vehicle safety enforcement plan. It's a written document. It's in a binder. And it sets out in very certain terms how our program will be administered and where our resources will be expended, whether or not I'm sitting in the chair. And I think you can draw comfort from that.
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your testimony. Could I have Dean Freeborn, Claude White? I think he wants to be included in this group. Tom Raleigh and Representative Kraft. I have to spread some more chairs in there. That we got Brad Anderson and Gene Wilkinson, too. Can you all get up there?
Sure.
Anybody bring the cards?
Bring the cards. Bring the chair.
There is security in numbers, too.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll be brief and then I'll be leaving, so you'll have an opportunity to consolidate the group here. For the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp from House District 17. I had the honor of chairing the Farm Plate Task Force during the interim, and it was made up of many of the individuals you see in front of us and our friends from ODOT. We met several times, talked about this issue, discussed possible alternatives, and before I go any further, first of all, let me say that the MCSAP program, I believe, is an important program, and I think that it has proven to be effective, and I would like to see it continued. And I think generally most of us feel that way. Farmers, by nature, are independent folks. I'm a fifth-generation Oregon farmer, and we sometimes feel assaulted from all sides, which is not unusual for natural resource folks, loggers, ranchers. And it seems that there is a fair amount of, and I think, Representative Beyer, you kind of hit the nail on the head, a discomfort with going forward in this particular piece of legislation as it's written, because we think that as farmers, and I say we, and I'm speaking as a farmer now and not as chairman of the task force, that ODOT has done a great job, and we love Greg Delpanti, but someday he's going to retire, and we don't know who will take his place down the road. We don't know what philosophical drivers will be permeating the mindset of his replacement and what might occur out of that, especially if farm inspections were to become a routine, targeted habit for farmers during the harvest when we can least afford the time. Because in Oregon, anyway, harvest time is critical. Time is money during harvest in this state. So, having said that, let me come back to my role as a chairman of this task force. I think in our discussions it became pretty apparent that the federal government really cares not so much about the numbers of inspections that are done, but rather that the state of Oregon has the authority to do them. And I find that a bit curious in some respects, because the goal ought to be ultimate farm truck safety. And Greg Delpanti, I think, made it very clear to you that farm trucks in Oregon don't have a safety problem. Of the truck wrecks that are occurring here, they aren't farm trucks. And that's very, very provable statistically. But nonetheless, the federal government feels that this is absolutely a necessary direction. So, we, as a task force, sat down and we discussed a number of options, including bringing forward legislation, which you have in front of you. But it also included the concept of a waiver, because we felt to some extent that this entire direction was duplicative and unnecessary. And so that's really how the waiver issue came forward. Greg Del Ponte and his staff worked diligently to make that request. We had to work diligently, it seems, to get the federal government to publish it in the Federal Register so that a comment period could move forward, which occurred, has ended, and many of us, in fact, a large number of farmers and interested parties, including myself, wrote letters in favor of the waiver request. However, it appears that the Federal Department of Transportation is not being timely in their response to us in that regard. And so right now we're engaged in an effort in asking our congressional delegations to move forward and contact Secretary of Transportation Mineta and ask him to approve this request quickly. Because the obvious issue is the time sensitivity of the fact that we are involved in our legislative session. If we don't deal with this issue now, either through the request circumstance or through legislation, then we will most likely lose the funds, and all of the threats of the federal government are likely to come to fruition, unfortunately. So I would say that if it does come down to the fact that we are unable to receive a favorable response from the federal government in regards to the waiver request, that then this legislation should be, in my opinion, modified. And I'm speaking now as a farmer and not the chairman of the task force. One of the things we did talk about in the task force, however, was the fact that if we had to go down this direction, would it be possible for the department by rule to adopt a rule whereby farmers could self-certify the safety of their trucks? And I think that's a reasonable direction that ought to be considered. It seems to me logical that if the department can have the authority by statute, which this bill would grant, but yet not be able to devote any resources to this, that the federal government ought to, if that's acceptable to the federal government, then it ought to be acceptable to the federal government that farmers could self-certify by rule under this statute. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will end my testimony, take any questions, and if there are none, then I need to proceed to another meeting.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Representative Greenhouse.
Good morning again. Are you suggesting then that we hold on to this bill till later in the session to see what comes out of the federal waiver request?
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlick, yes. As a farmer, I would say that we need to, at some point, you'll have to move it out of the committee before the time period ends for committee consideration of House bills, I would think. And if you're going to do that, then I would ask that you amend the bill to allow consideration for some of the concerns you're going to hear expressed here in a moment by my fellow farmers. Again, we are pushing the congressional delegation to vociferously intervene on our behalf with the Secretary Mineta to try and get an answer. It would be very nice to have an answer from them before we have to move the legislation forward. From my point of view, it is a disincentive to the federal government to grant our waiver request if we do move forward with the bill right away. Because then if there would be no incentive for them, they would simply say, well, you don't need the waiver because you've passed the statute. You know? So as a farmer, that would be my request of this committee, is that you wait a bit until we're able to try to get some resolution on the waiver issue before we go forward.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
I'll go next.
Okay.
Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Jean Underhill Wilkinson, Associate Director for Governmental Affairs with the Farm Bureau. I'll make my comments brief so you can hear from the farmers sitting before you. I am a staff person from the Farm Bureau, but I'm also a farmer's daughter. My parents are wheat farmers in eastern Oregon in Representative Mabry's district, and I drove wheat truck for many, many years. Growing up, and during the critical harvest season, which for us lasts a continual month, nonstop, 16 to 18 hour days, trying to get the wheat in from the field to the market in a timely way before it started raining and potentially crop destruction can occur. It's very critical that we get the commodity out of the field as soon as possible. My father is a mechanic, as most farmers are, and would mechanic on the trucks and fix them up for harvest just as he did the other machinery that needed to be used. And we ran trucks in circles from the farm to market to the storage facility nonstop for a month straight. Now, there were certain rules that all the drivers needed to comply with, and that being we could never, ever exceed 30 miles an hour going along the road. So there's a lot of traffic holdups, and slow trucks traveling down the road is the common practice in the farm community. And just to give you a taste of what happens. A lot of the trucks are older trucks. They are traveling on secondary roads for the most part, on very familiar routes, going in circles during the harvest season from the farm to market, and going at very reduced speeds for the most part. So I think this regulatory program, this bill, House Bill 2217, really imposes a new regulatory program on the farm industry, and it raises a lot of concerns. It is true that most of the regulations that the state currently has are duplicative with the federal government, as Greg Delpani pointed out, but it's really seen by the farm community as a situation where the federal government is meddling in an area where they don't belong. As Greg Delpani pointed out, he runs his program based on performance, and the farm trucks in Oregon have an exceptional performance record. Of 11,000 truck accidents from 1995 to 2001, only 89 of those involved farm-plated trucks. Farm-plated trucks account for less than 1% of the accidents in this state. Exceptional performance, and so the state, rightly so, doesn't contribute a smaller amount of resources, at least, to the farm industry, and instead poses those resources and those inspections and those enforcement to the areas of the state where the large trucks are running with traffic. So I guess in closing with my remarks, I would suggest that maybe if the federal government, I understand preemption issues, and if the federal regulations preempt the lesser state regulations, perhaps this legislation isn't even needed. At a minimum, I would hope the U.S. Department of Transportation would give us an answer on the exemption request that the Department of Transportation made on our behalf. The federal government has set the timelines from day one. They established an ultimatum that the state would not receive their grant money unless the state yanked our farm exemption that's existed since 1978. It took congressional nudging to get the federal government to publish our exemption request in the Federal Register, and so that was delayed. That comment period ended, I think, at the end of January, and the U.S. Department of Transportation now has not made a decision on that exemption request. And at the same time, they have the ultimatum that if we don't accomplish this task by the end of the session, the state would lose its $5 million. So I'm hoping they've been aware of our time constraints and our issues from the very start, and Andy Eno from the U.S. Department of Transportation is very good to communicate with. We realize that he's not making the decisions on this issue. These decisions, I think, are primarily made in Washington, D.C., but I would hope we could at least get an answer so we could check off that option and move forward. And if we could take this issue slowly in this committee, it would give the farming community time to get together again and look at some options at maybe I know it's going to be to a limited extent, but perhaps create and craft a tailor-made program for agriculture's needs in the state. Thank you.
Thanks. Mr. Chair.
I represent Dinkelner.
Yeah, I have a quick question before we hear other testimony. And the question I have is that we heard from the state and the federal government that Oregon, that other states have this program, and that other states inspect farm trucks and do that in order to receive their federal funds. So, Gene, I'm just trying to understand, why is Oregon so unique? And have you talked with Washington State and the California Farm Bureau about how they've dealt with this issue? Because I'm just trying to understand why Oregon needs to have a different exemption than other states that are doing similar farming activities.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I do not know how the other states are operating with their program. Maybe the Department of Transportation could tell us why our exemption was implemented in the first place back in 1978. I'm not sure what the intention or reasoning was at that time. But it probably depends on the state, each state Department of Transportation, on how they, the judgments and the decisions and the policies they have in place for making the determinations on how many inspections or to what degree they enforce farm trucks. And it probably depends to some degree on the unique situation of each of the agriculture community in each state. You know, we are lucky here at this time to have a performance-based system that Greg Delpani leads. And again, we have all the faith that that he will make the right decisions and do right by the farm industry, because he's proven that and shown that over the last few years. But again, this is a new program that would be implemented or imposed in this state, and we don't know and are uncertain as to what influence it could have in the state's own decisions and autonomy to make its own decisions. And the state has made good decisions, obviously, so far, and we'd like them to continue to be able to do that.
Representative Greenlee.
If, of all, like, this is necessary, Representative Krupp talked about the possibility of a self inspection program. Would it be possible, instead of that, to create a sort of a preventive certification program? I mean, I understand during harvest it's a huge problem to slow a truck down, mm-hmm. but could there be the process that would create, either through authorized stations or through the state, the development of a voluntary pre-harvest certification program that would then, you know, have a sticker that the trucks would be certified, sort of similar to what's done on the automatic weighing system mm-hmm. in advance with this.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, I think that that's a good idea. That's something we briefly talked about before. We were depending on this waiver application that we sent in, and we were working on getting lots of farmers to make comments, and we had over 100 comments sent in to the U.S. Department of Transportation and legislators to comment approving and supporting our exemption application. So that's why over the last few months we have not been concentrating on the development of programs like that, but those would be the center of our conversations in working hard to resolve this problem to move this bill forward.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Is there any other questions? Which end do you guys want to start from?
I'll go.
Believer.
My name's Dean Freeborn. I'm president of the Polk County Farm Bureau, and I farm about 10 miles west of here. I guess just right off the bat, to answer Representative Greenlee's question, is that the main thing I'm here today for is to ask for a delay in this until we get an understanding of what the U.S. ODOT is going to do. I've been working with Representative Hooley's office, Representative Greg Walden's office. Both of them have told me that being the time for written comments was January 28th, I think, was the deadline, that it takes a lot of times up to 2 months for things like this to even get any action. Well, by my counting, it's February 28th, March 28th, we're about at 2 months. As far as I know, all the congressional people we have been working with, Representative Hooley, Representative Walden, Representative Wyden, Senator Smith, are supporting our position for this exemption. I think it's been stated this morning that our own ODOT is sitting here saying that, you know, there isn't a problem. It's basically just the threat of, and Mr. Delpani brought it up, a threat of the feds saying you're going to do this or we're going to take this money away from you. I would hope that they would understand and hope that the U.S. ODOT people that are here in this room see the program that is in place in Oregon, that there is no reason for expanding this, and would work to get this exemption for us. The one thing that I might mention that we are a little different in the state of Oregon is being the grass seed capital of the world. There isn't any other state in the United States that produces the amount of grass seed that we do. One thing that makes is a lot of trucks with dump beds on them, dump boxes. Well, one of the regulations, as I understand it anyway, would be we would have to construct some kind of a rear bumper on the back of these trucks. Well, I will be searching for a design, if this goes through, of how we can quickly take a rear bumper off that still meets the standards to be able to dump these trucks when we're traveling on county roads. I guess that's something else that I'd like to point out, is where most of my seeds processed is about 4 miles away from where our main farm is. We never are on a state highway, but yet this interstate thing to me is very confusing, and maybe hopefully you folks understand it better than I do. But it's my understanding, as it being the grass seed that I grow leaves the state of Oregon, and I'm an interstate shipper. So would fall under all these things, even though my trucks go less than 5 miles to take this product, and then I'm done with it. I mean, the big trucks come in and take it either to Portland for it to be shipped overseas, or when it goes to every other state in the country for usage, it's a big truck that's doing that. But yet, being the way it's worded, I would fall under those regulations just traveling the 4 to 5 miles hauling this product. If it's used just, if I, like some other states, and I would just use Idaho as probably a good example, and maybe Claude White could mention this, but a lot of their products where they've got such a large dairy, livestock, et cetera, ag community, a lot of their stuff is used right within the state. So maybe that's the reason that Idaho's ODOT, or I shouldn't say ODOT, IDOT, what would it be called? IDOT, would look at it a little differently. So it's, I guess what I would hope is that we can hold off on this and see what comes of the Fed's decision. Hopefully that they will recognize that what, I don't want to put a truck out that's not safe either. I mean, it's my liability. It's every farmer that's sending those trucks out. It's just some of these things like this rear bumper thing that could cause, obviously it's not causing any problem, but it would fall under some of these guidelines the way I understand it. And this interstate thing, I heard it say it's sort of spelled out. Well, that was a thing that we've talked about for quite a long time in our committee, because I served on that task force, is what really is whatever. And so it's not quite as laid out in black and white as some people might make you believe. So that's, I'll stop there, because I'm going to have to get out and move a vehicle, or I will get a ticket.
And I assure you, they do ticket them.
Oh, yeah. So. And it's not a safety concern.
No, it's not even moving, but I'm sure that they would ticket it. So.
It appears to me, what I've heard testimony this morning, and that this is probably more driven by the golden rule than it is a safety rule. It's those who've got the gold make the rules. Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's not a good
point. Or you're close to being right.
Right. It is. Sir, would you like to give your testimony?
Thank you.
Brad.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Brad Anderson. I'm a wheat farmer over in Arlington, Oregon, so I got the distinction of traveling quite a ways to speak with everyone today. I, too, am a fifth-generation farmer, and been driving trucks since I was a little kid, so this is an issue that's near and dear to my heart. I would hope to echo some of Dean's comments here that we could wait on this a little bit to see if we do get this exemption. Obviously, if we don't, then something has to be done. We can't pass up $5 million. I mean, we, as a state, we're tight as it is, and I understand that's something that can't be passed up. So if we need to have an inspection program, we need to have something that works for the farmers, something that's quick and efficient. To echo what Mr. Greenlick over here said, we either need some sort of inspection station we can take these trucks to in June, or a self-certification program like Mr. Krupp was talking about. So when we are taking our products to market, it's not a cumbersome process. Oh, gosh, we're going to get weighed. Now we're going to get inspected. It's going to take quite a bit of time. if I can relate one personal story, one of our trucks last summer was stopped on the way to the elevator just to get weighed, and by the time they set up the jump scales, weighed the truck, looked at the license requirements and everything, it was a 30-minute process. If now we have to get inspected, that 30 minutes turns into an hour, and that means my combines are sitting there waiting extra long for the truck to return. I mean, as farmers, we're certainly not advocating we have unsafe trucks. I mean, we look at them close. I mean, we want something on the road that is you know, safe for our drivers as well as the general public. So once again, if we do not get this exemption, let's work together so we can get a program that is something that works for the agricultural community. That's all I have.
Thank you, and I think from the standpoint that if safety is our real, real concern, that we'd want these trucks to be inspected before they were on the road, not after they were on the road.
Exactly.
Representative Mabry.
The two of you gentlemen and Gene referred to, hold off, and yet the way the legislative process works, if we don't do something in this committee and get it to the Senate, we're fairly soon. We're probably going to miss this year, and we stand the risk of losing that $5 million one way or another. Would you feel comfortable if we went ahead and moved this and tried to get some kind of delay in the Senate until we get some kind of answer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mabry, I think what I'm speaking to in terms of delay is to just give us, a couple weeks, not to hold a work session on the bill today. I wouldn't support moving it out of committee today, but just to give us a short amount of time to get worked out whether there's any possibilities that the U.S. Department of Transportation would agree to as to tailor fit this legislation for the agriculture community. We just want to exhaust those possibilities before moving the bill forward like it is.
Representative Meyer.
Thank you. Have you been working on that at this point, or are you hoping to start?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, we have had previous discussions on what some of the options were. When we came across this exemption issue, and by the way, we came across that idea because a letter written to Senator Wyden by the U.S. Department of Transportation suggested that as an option that we could use. So that's why the Department of Transportation helped us file the exemption waiver request. So we've been concentrating on that effort. Now that it may seem likely that they're going to either not act on our request or deny our request, now we have to get back on the track of looking over our options to move a bill forward.
Representative Mabry.
I had a follow-up question. It got away from me, but I like the idea of the suggestion of self-certification or something like that that gets it done in advance. Is it possible that's something that ODOT could do as a part of their agreement with the feds? In other words, the feds want them to make sure that this is being complied with, but how they do that maybe is up to ODOT to say, okay, self-certification is the way we're going to accomplish this. Is that... I'm asking a question out of ignorance here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mabry, I don't know all the answers to that. Those are good questions as to what flexibility the state has and what autonomy the state has to carry out those compliance with those regulations in the way that the state feels it's fit. Maybe Greg Dalpani or the U.S. Department of Transportation Representative Andy Eno could shed some light on those questions.
Thank you.
We're going to run out of time. We need to finish this hearing, and we've got one more bill to hear. Mm-hmm. And I want these gentlemen's testimony on the record and a couple other people we have, too. So.
My name's Tom Brawley. I'm a farmer, family farmer, south of Salem in Marion County. We do run several F-plated trucks, I would like to say that just the previous testimony, I would certainly back it 100%. I'd like to give you a little different spin. Listening to your bill that you considered earlier, I'd like to say that I am a supporter of the federal government. I served in the U.S. military, and I continue to pay federal taxes, just like everyone else does. However, I think there's a limit to which the federal government should reach down into our states, and after we pay those taxes and give them the money to regulate, to deal with and do things at the federal level that are needed. Some of the ways they've impacted we, the farmers, in the last several years is they legislate embargoes so that we can't sell wheat to different countries. They have regulated NAFTA and GATT agreements that have really hurt us in our marketing. And so now they want to reach down and further control us and micro-regulate us at the state level. I think this is an opportunity with our money. I think this is an opportunity for us to say, we are Oregon, we are unique. And we can regulate ourselves at this level and perhaps still make them happy. I don't think we should just go in lockstep with these people at the federal level for a few dollars. And that's what they're having us do. I don't know where it goes from there. But I think that we need to stand up, be counted, be ourselves, come up with a regulation that will meet what we need and perhaps satisfy them. And I request that you delay long enough that we do that.
Go ahead.
My name is Claude White. I'm a farmer out in the Rickrell area. I'm also wear two different hats. I have farm trucks and I have commercial vehicles. Back to one of the questions on inspection, you can take them, I think, which you can ask ODOT, you can take them to a like Bratton International or some of the truck shops and have them pre-inspected. I would like to see us wait on this bill and see what can happen over the next two or three weeks, I guess. I guess that's about all I can add to it that I can think of right now.
Okay.
Questions? If I could, we have three more people to. We lost our chair, so you're stuck with me. I apologize for that. We have three more people to testify on this bill, and we want to hear from them. But we also have two representatives here that need to get to other committees. So I'd like to recess on this. We'll come back to it and get your testimony. Recess on this and open a public hearing on House Bill 3510. And call Representative. Oh, we got a bang. And call Representative Verger and Representative Anderson forward.
Careful with
something you keep going. Vice Chair Mabry and members of the committee, I'm Joanne Verger. I'm Oregon State Representative from District 9. I'm happy to be here today, but I'm not speaking in opposition or in support of this bill. I am here primarily to give you a perspective on jurisdictional exchange. Coming from the city of Coos Bay as the mayor of Coos Bay for 8 years, we were involved in a jurisdictional exchange in our city that has worked quite well. I'd like to preface my remarks by saying that Oregon is not a cookie-cutter state. We have very different demands, very different needs in each one of our communities. And I think that nothing exemplifies this more than the jurisdictional exchange. And that is, it has to be treated on a one-by-one basis. In the city of Coos Bay, we traded 23 miles in a jurisdictional exchange for $4.8 million, which would be paid in three payments. All of these roads, all 23 miles, could be considered and were used as city streets. All through Oregon, as you go and travel, you will go even into a main street of a town, and it's a state highway, but it is treated as a city street. We did not have any improvement on these roads for 20 years. There was not going to be any work done on Ocean Boulevard or Newmark or the Cape Arago Highway or the Coos River Highway. It took a number of negotiations before this jurisdictional exchange took place. Once it was done, the funds that were received were placed in an account that future councils cannot get to without a vote of the people. We then passed a law that all interest could be used in maintenance of the roads. What has happened since this exchange took place is that the interest monies from that exchange have been used on small repairs on all of these roads. Because we could now take interest money and use it on Ocean Boulevard, Arago Highway, and the Coos Highway, we then expanded the urban renewal just a very, very small amount mileage to encompass the rest of Newmark, and that road now will be made into a 3-lane or 4-lane road going out to the beach all the way to the Y. So you can see that the jurisdictional exchange has been a great benefit. It also has developed some property or enabled us to offer some property to several national firms, Walgreen, a drugstore, Michaels, Starbucks, Jack in the Box, other businesses that are coming in and looking at it. I just can't emphasize enough that each city is different. We were not going to have any work done on these streets. And so we felt, even though Ocean Boulevard is a very long road to maintain, we felt that over the years, by using the interest off the money, we could gradually pay as you go. And being physically conservative, I have to tell you that appeals to me, and I think it was a good thing. I think the principle stays secure from the hands of people that would want to grab it. If all the people in that area feel it's a good thing and vote for it, then I think that that's well done. So thank you for having me come in and talk about jurisdictional exchange, and please excuse me while I go to some other things.
Thank you, John.
Good morning, Mr. Vice Chair and members. For the record, I'm Representative Gordon Anderson, District 3, Josephine County, Grants Pass, Cave Junction. I come to you today in support of House Bill 3510 for several reasons, and I'm going to restrict my testimony and bring before you our city manager, who can bring the financial details to you. But just to give you a little background, I've been on the Rogue Valley Area Commission on Transportation for the last 8 years. The last 2 years, I served as a co-chairman for that Area Commission on Transportation. And over that period of time of years, we developed some criteria, and we were told by ODOT that we were probably one of the leaders and one of the more effective area commissions in developing criteria on which different projects should be done and how they should be funded. We had a number of different criteria, like priority of need, and engineering studies, and local jurisdictions, and did it fit into the local transportation plan. That plan was working very well, but over the last several years, by administrative rule, ODOT has come in and suggested ways in which they can make it easier on their budget, but I feel make it much more difficult on the local entities, the counties and the cities. House Bill 3510 does not make it impossible for a jurisdictional exchange to occur. It just says that it should not be required as a condition. In other words, you shouldn't be forced to take an exchange if that project is a high criteria project. Before I leave, I'd like to read testimony from the county, Josephine County, from Robert Weber, their Public Works Director. And he writes, Josephine County is in support of House Bill 3510 that prohibits the ODOT from making jurisdictional transfers of state highways to local governments a condition of modernization. The reason is that Josephine County cannot afford to take over maintenance responsibility for any additional highways without further deterioration of our existing county transport system. Typically, the highways ODOT considers for transfer are classed as district highways, and there are four such highways in Josephine County. In recent years, Josephine County Public Works has been downsizing its staff and major road maintenance programs. We cut staff by 10% this year, and we'll have to cut another 10% next year. We've also cut our annual chip seal resurfacing program by 60% in the last 2 years. The public works budget in 1991 was $11.4 million. This year it will be $9.0 million. Due to inflation, this year's $9 million budget will buy only $6.2 million worth of labor, materials, and equipment when comparing today's prices to 1991 prices. We are currently not able to provide adequate basic maintenance for our highways. Our county cannot afford to take on further road maintenance responsibilities and efforts by ODOT to make this occur as a condition of proceeding with modernization projects. It is unreasonable and would shift large burden of the financial cost to local government. Again, this does not require these prevent them from occurring. It just makes it more a voluntary partnership between the state and the county, and it will definitely help those counties and those cities which are smaller and less capable, less affluent, to meet the needs of modernization in the future.
Question?
Good morning, Representative Anderson. You think it's likely? I mean, it seems to me that it's likely the criterion will change with this. I mean, I could imagine the criterion mix being giving higher priorities to those that have this kind of agreement than lower priorities to those that don't. Is that, you expect that's likely to happen with
this? Exactly,
that?
And that's the problem.
Yeah. So you're going to be less likely to get Josephine County projects, I suspect, until they really get to be.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I feel that the modernization project should be carried on their priority as a need in that region. If it's a high priority and the road is going downward fast and needs to be done, it shouldn't be because a richer city or a richer county can afford to do it and a poorer city or a poorer county cannot afford to do it in exchanging. It's exchanging future maintenance for the ability to modernize that section of road.
This bill is not going to help that.
Right.
Other questions? Representative Byer.
Thank you for being here. We happen to have an issue going on in our city right now over this, and I know they're working on it, trying to work it out, but basically it's been that if the jurisdictional transfer is not agreed to, it drops from the local step. My concern is this really is not a good candidate to be part of the state highway system. And there isn't a real incentive for them to repair this road. And so by doing this, it kind of is leaving it up to the cities as to whether this is a priority for the cities or not to have this road repaired. And they made a very, I will say that ODOT made a very generous offer in this jurisdictional transfer agreement, and I've met with them a couple times, and hopefully they're still continuing to work on this. But I have concerns both ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't like the requirement, but I also know that somebody's going to have to pay for the road, and it should be the people that are using it. And whether it's a city road or a state road is the question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, I think what I'm saying is that we had a good system going and then funding dropped off the table. What we need to do eventually, and this might in some way encourage that, is to get back to funding on a gas tax or a white mile, you know, licensing, different things that will bring the monies back to ODOT so they can go back to priority projects and not bludgeon the cities or the counties into coming up with money to get a desperately needed job done. So, again, this is not requiring it. It's just it's making it voluntary, but not mandating it.
Other questions? Thank you, Representative.
Are you continuing with this project or
yes,
going
I
back?
Yes, I think we will. We'll go to Bill Peterson. And, Janet, I've neglected to ask you for a summary of the bill. Is there anything that hasn't been covered that you want to talk about?
No, Mr. Chair. I think that the bill is pretty self-explanatory and what Representative Anderson did also.
Thank you. You have a copy of our county's representative's information. And I'd like to bring up my former city manager, Bill Peterson, who experienced this all the way through the project in Grants Pass.
Thank you.
Bill, will excuse me. I need to rest.
Yes, we will.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
May I begin, Mr. Chair?
You may go ahead.
Thank you. I'm Bill Peterson. I'm the city manager in Grants Pass. I did have the pleasure of working with Representative Anderson as both a city councilor and then subsequently as the mayor. I have immense respect for the elected folks that are willing to take this stuff on. And for y'all, putting up with all this kind of stuff every day is really a challenge. And I understand what you have to face as people try to put all of this wonderful information in part. The perfect seed that's going to convince you to do just exactly what it is that they believe is the right public policy. So I really respect the elected process. This legislation is derived actually from our city council's legislative process because they are very concerned. They feel as if the city of Grants Pass has been extorted to play a game in transferring jurisdiction between multiple roads. We have a couplet that goes right through the center of our downtown. The couplet is a one-way couplet. You go southbound and you cross the famous Caveman Bridge and you come the other way over 7th Street. That's our downtown. It's critical to us. There's only two real pathways through which you can get through Grants Pass. You go down this 6th Street, jump over the Caveman Bridge, or you go around on Highway 199, which we developed in conjunction with the Department of Transportation about 10, nearly 12 years ago, and built a third bridge across the Rogue River. And Grants Pass is the community like many of the communities in which you live also. We're kind of wonderfully situated with a river right through the middle and a railroad tracks and mountains down both sides. And if you can dream up any kind of geographic constraint to make it more difficult, hey, we did it. You know, we did great. So it's just about as tough a place as you can physically imagine trying to get around. You got railroad tracks, rivers, you got all this stuff. So the only place that we can actually turn at this point is to get across the Rogue River. Now, the Rogue River, of course, is famous, and we love it. It's what we're about, and it's also a heck of an obstacle to drive over. And you truly must have bridges to have the capacity to do this. So when we did the third bridge project, we developed a corridor in association with the Department of Transportation and the State of Oregon. At that time, we were asked as a good local government partner to do a number of things. Build some parallel roadways, which we have done, to also accept a jurisdictional exchange, which we did. We took at that time about 7 miles of roadways that had previously been the state highway route east-west through our community. We are now being asked to look at what would be the right kind of solution for transportation in Grants Pass. Let me remind you a little bit about how transportation is all financed. You guys know this a lot better than I do. On the macro level, you know, about half of every gas tax dollar and licensing dollar goes directly to the state, about 30% to counties, about 20% to local governments, purportedly all based on what our respective mix of roadway responsibilities are. And then we've got a state-dominated transportation role. The state literally is the primary mover throughout all of our state. At the local government level, about half of what we do is financed directly from gasoline taxes, and then we work like crazy to develop other kinds of transportational systems, including system development charges, transportation utilities. In fact, you're going to get the opportunity to see some legislation this session that will deal with our transportation utility efforts locally to try to find ways to finance how in the world you pay for maintaining roads. So So you know that your local government partners have lots of financial difficulties, and in this case, what we're facing, unlike what Coos Bay faced, where they felt that they received a sufficient fiscal resource, in Grants Pass, the 6th and 7th Street corridor, one of the core routes, was rebuilt, oh gosh, nearly 4 years ago now. In the rebuilding process, Grants Pass has been first to praise the Department of Transportation about how they changed. They did wonderful work in trying to help us build a community resource and a highway. Now we are being told our community resource, because we wanted to build it in a way that would enhance our community the best, we no longer have a highway route. We now have what they are interpreting to be an urban arterial or something else, and as a result, we'd have to end up in some kind of jurisdictional exchange. Here's what I did to run the numbers on the exchange, and I hope you guys will bear with me for just a minute. $12-13 million builds this couplet. That's the project. It was just recently completed. If you use the ENR, the Engineering News Record, kind of standard of the cost that roadway improvements go up routinely over time, and you compare the ENR to the amount of return, financial return, you can get on an investment, we would have to put $356,000 a year into a trust account for 45 years to get to the close of that period, the 45-year useful life of the roadway, to be in a position to rebuild it. That's how much it will cost at that point. In the meantime, we'd have $200,000-$300,000 a year in ongoing maintenance. So what you're talking about is 75% of the gasoline tax proceeds available to our local government would be consumed just on this portion of exchange. Now, the Department of Transportation is also asking for a river loop, as you heard from our county, and for a jurisdictional exchange on a piece of Highway 99. You put all the numbers together, and it would take more resource annually than we get in total proceeds from gasoline taxes to keep us in a position of staying even over time. Now, I'm confident that Representative Verger and Coos Bay has actually looked at what the reconstruction long-term costs of their relative roadways are, but we certainly have looked at them, and I can tell you there's no way that we can keep anywhere close to a financial par should we accept those roadways. We learned loud and clear when we exchanged for the third bridge that the maintenance of high traffic roadways like our ENF couplet is more than what our local government can handle. We got our first couple of traffic lights out of that whole mess. We've learned a whole lot about trying to maintain those things. It's a whole different world. We moved to a different level. So let me summarize this way. We're your local government partner. We don't have a lot of fiscal resource. Currently, we are precluded from being able to take on improvements that are very necessary for our particular area by a jurisdictional exchange perception of requirement. It may not even be a perception. What we are doing is asking legislatively for you as the legislature to firmly say it is not a requirement of modernization to accept jurisdictional exchanges. Now, it may, Representative Greenlink, still mean that our project may be the lowest possible priority because we don't accept a jurisdictional exchange. That may occur. We may not get far in even taking this approach. But we have no other places to go. We don't have the financial capacity to go in the direction that we're currently being approached. So we're asking you for your support and supporting Representative Anderson's introduced legislation, House Bill 3510.
Thank you. Did anyone have questions of this witness? Thank you. Seeing none.
Thank you for coming from so far away.
Yes,
My pleasure.
I'm at this point then. We have four others that want to testify on this. They're all hired guns, if you will. They're around here on a regular basis and can be called back readily.
You didn't say that.
Yes, I did. So I'm gonna recess this hearing and go back to House Bill 2217. And we have three people that I promised that would testify on this. Bearing in mind, gentlemen, Kurt Curtis, Kevin Peterson, and Sergeant John And I apologize, I can't read your last name, Sergeant.
You're good, sir.
I apologize. Thank you. Bearing in mind, we're supposed to be on the floor at 11. We can be a little bit late, but try to limit your testimony if you can. Thank you.
In the interest of time, Chair Mabry, if I could start, we'll
you may
get going.
Go ahead.
Chair Mabry, members of the committee, my name is Kurt Curtis, and I'm a sergeant with the Oregon State Police assigned to the Patrol Services Division out of our general headquarters. You have my written testimony. I'm going to be as brief as possible. The Oregon State Police, out of federal funding, that's possibly in jeopardy by not passing this bill, receives about $400,000 a year to conduct motor vehicle inspections and have our officers trained and to go out and conduct these inspections on traffic. Our stops are based on probable cause. In other words, the vehicle has to be in violation of the law before we stop the vehicle, so we're just not doing random checks of every car truck that we see running up and down the road. They have to commit a violation in our presence, and the officer would make the stop and then conduct whatever inspection is necessary. Part of this funding does offer us a chance to have some specialty enforcement projects where we have called trucker check. We do these twice a year at the scales. We pick a random location yearly and at each one, and basically for a period of 48 hours solid, we make contact with every truck that comes through the scales and do an inspection on a random basis. These inspections have been very fruitful to the agency in making roadways safe. One of the last inspections we did, the last truck we inspected in the 48-hour period, we stopped the driver. He was under the influence of narcotics. When all was said and done, his vehicle was put out of service for multiple violations, being not safe to be on the roadway. In going through the vehicle, we found several open containers of alcoholic beverage, Blitz and Budweiser beer. We also found a loaded shotgun in there with intermixed rounds of slugs and double-aught buck, which is not for quail hunting. I mean, it's out to do serious damage. And a bandolero with 20 more rounds of intermixed slugs and double-aught buck.
That's my kind of truck.
So there is a need for these, and we do come across the ultimate in the extremes of the violators out there. Last year, we did 15,692 inspections as an agency by our road officers. I'll just let you read the testimony there. We put several out of service because the drivers weren't able to be on the road at that time due to hour restrictions or not even having commercial licenses, and several violations we put out of service because the vehicles were non-compliant. I mean, it was unsafe for them to be on the road, and that means we stop them right then and there. Thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
I don't see any. Who wants to be next?
I'll go.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, representatives, I'm Kevin Peterson. I'm the Motor Carrier Enforcement Program Coordinator for Clackamas County. Part of my duties is I head a multi-agency carrier enforcement team, which consists of sheriff's deputies from Clackamas County, and police officers from about 8-9 cities within the county. Prior to Clackamas County receiving any MCSAP funds, Sergeant Nacarado and I were the only certified truck inspectors in Clackamas County. Now with our MACE organization, the multi-agency that I mentioned, we have over 30. And these are police officers who, in amongst their other duties, are certified as truck inspectors and enforce the laws on trucks. I'll paraphrase my testimony that I handed in to you if I can. We did about 2,100 truck inspections in Clackamas County last year. The bulk of the inspections that we do, as Greg Dopani related to you earlier, are part of a probable cause stop. I would submit that when we all leave here and we're heading up the freeway and there's a truck right on our back bumper, we're not going to care whether it's got a farm plate or a red and white plate or a plate from Illinois. You're going to want that truck to stop that behavior. That's what we spend our time doing. We do not spend our time running around chasing farm trucks in particular, because in my county, we don't have a lot of safety issues with farm trucks. This legislation is not going to change how we do our enforcement. We try to affect driver behavior, and we're pretty successful at that. We received over $120,000 in reimbursements and training from ODOT through the MixSAP program. And I can say if that money were to go away, truck enforcement in Clackamas County would see a huge change. We'd be to be drastically reduced. We do this it complements our other duties. We're able to keep people certified and trained through ODOT. We wouldn't have the capacity to send them out of state to do that. That's just kind of an overview, but in the interest of time, I'll introduce Sergeant John Naccarato with the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office, seated to my left and your right.
And I was hoping you were going to let me say Naccarato because I screwed it up going in.
Go ahead. Okay, Vice Chair. Vice Chair, members of the committee, thanks for having me. My name is Sergeant John Naccarato. I'm the traffic supervisor for Clackamas County Sheriff's Department and run a team of six motor officers and supervise the other truck enforcement officials in Clackamas County as far as the enforcement piece. As Kevin Peterson spoke earlier, the MixSAP funds have been a huge blessing for our county. It's brought other people online. It's complemented the use of our equipment. We have portable printers now on our motorcycles. We're able to do truck inspections. This is part of the MixSAP funds to help us do our job easier. If these funds go away, that's going to drastically reduce our effective resources, the online resources that MixSAP provides for the training, the refresher courses, because as we know, if you don't use it, you lose it. And this is very important as far as truck enforcement in our county is concerned. This law is also going to bring it in compliance with federal law, which is, as law enforcement officers, we like. It's very easy when it's all the same. When trucks are crossing interstate lines and coming into the county, it's one book we have to reference to instead of five or six in the subparagraph of this, an administrative rule in ORS. It's very easy for us, so we're greatly support this bill and to keep the MixSAP funds coming to us in order to do our job. And like Kevin Peterson spoke of and Mr. Delpani, they give us the direction in which to proceed as far as our enforcement is concerned. We have a truck safety corridor in Clackamas County. We focus a lot of our efforts on that, along with Sergeant Kirk Curtis and his people with different enforcement details. So that's where we do most of our enforcement. And as far as an enforcement official, I strongly support the bill and urge you to swift action.
Thank you. Questions? I have one brief question of Andrew, if you're still. The question I asked earlier about the potential for the state allowing self-certification as part of compliance with this, is that anywhere near a potential or a possibility?
Real briefly, our rules, there's very few rules that apply to the farmers to begin with. But one of the things that is required is the maintenance area. And every year, an interstate farm operation would have to have an annual inspection of their vehicle. From that, there would be a sticker for their vehicle. Going back to whether the state could issue a CVSA decal, for example, that says, you know, this farmer's okay, and we're going to do that before the season starts. I think if we went and looked at it, that'd actually be contrary to what the Commercial Vehicle Safety Alliance, which is the association of all the state enforcement folks that you know issue those. I think that'd probably be in conflict with what they would their bylaws. And under the interstate system, under the federal system, there's no such thing. Put it in perspective. A truck's chances of getting checked in any given year are about 1 to 2%. So even those that are targeted that are a problem, just because of the sheer magnitude of volume.
When I worked at a automobile dealership, it was very common, in the spring and summer of the year before harvest, that farmers brought their vehicles in for some safety check and what have you, and yet that wasn't through any official source. So
yeah, and now there is some guidelines, federal guidelines. The state doesn't have the equivalent, but there, these things have to be checked at least once a year. So that's something that's been in effect probably about 7 or 8 years.
Okay,
at least.
Thank you, sir. Thank you all.
If I could just give one more point, and it's also in my testimony, but I'd like to reiterate it. We really look at the truck enforcement in Clackamas County as much as a leveling of the playing field, if you will, as safety. If you have if you have a business on one side of the street and he has a good maintenance program for his trucks and he charges X amount for his product, and you have a business on the other side of the street, he charges X for his product, but he doesn't have that maintenance and safe trucks and everything else, it really puts the first, you know, the first farmer or business or whatever it might be at a disadvantage. And in our county, the farmers and all the other businesses, the loggers and everybody else, and it's a pretty good sized county, have really embraced the work that we do. We inspect a lot of farm trucks now. They come by, and if we've got time to inspect them, we'll inspect them. They don't get a sticker because they're not interstate, but, you know, hey, what's this supposed to look like? We do a lot of education and everything. This really isn't going to change any of that. We do a lot of good with the resources that we have now. So,
thank you very much. Thank you all. With that, I'll declare the public hearing closed, and this was never scheduled today for a work session, so we'll look at that later. Thank you.
All righty. Thank you.
With that, seeing no other business for the committee, we'll stand adjourned.